but our reach can go even wider. Working together with intention, we can do our part to undesign the red line. And here to tell us much more is April DeSimone.
Thank you, Ed, for that wonderful introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's wake up, right? It's been a long day. Words fall short to express Designing the We's gratitude to share in today's experience. From the vibrant discussions from the panelists to the insightful exchanges I'm having with so many of you, all of it contributes to the important work of moving beyond the momentum of today's conference to really begin seeding opportunities within community that brings actionable meaning to what it means to work to build equity and undesign this red line. I especially want to acknowledge the entire HAND organization and their sponsors for really bringing forward with intentionality the hard work to create this ensemble. And I think I can speak for most of you, if not all in this room, we're appreciating their symphony. You can clap for them. Am I pointing at something? Sorry. It was about 4 in the morning when I opened the email that had the questions that was posed to all of us for this conference. How many of you got that email? Raise your hand. Wow, no one. It was an important framing to really ask, why are you committed to deconstructing our past and redesigning our future? How will your work undesign the red line? And when you're glancing at the clock at 4 in the morning, with less than 24 hours having slept, the why becomes real, folks. And you start to question, wow, these are not only very important questions and timely, and all that's accentuated again by our panelists, but they do something much more important. They reverberate the current sentiment and climate where you have works from Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, you have books from Richard Rothstein like The Color of Law, as well as Matthew Desmond's Evicted, that's currently on display in exhibition form at the National Building Museum. It really captures a sentiment in this country that people have had enough, and people want to show up honestly to conversations around how systems and structures perpetuate inequities in our society, and how in doing so, we create a shameful democracy in this country. The how and the why for Designing the We began in 2015 over fish tacos and a beef quesadilla. And I want to have my Designing the We team stand up, and my co-founding partner, Braden Crooks, raise his hand, because it was the intentionality of very unlikely collaborators that came together. Braden and I come from extremely different backgrounds, culturally, financially, and in every different way. But we both shared a passion around what did it mean to bring design skills to change the built environment in ways that bring more equitable and inclusive human experiences. And we drafted a little note with each other, and we said, we are unlikely collaborators. We are a team bridging differences in professional and personal experience to co-create a strong we, capable of grappling with complex problems from multiple perspectives. This is what we mean by Designing the We. And with that, Designing the We was born. Our work wanted to move beyond the complexities that face us along racial and class lines. We wanted to delve into very pure forms of what human needs meant. And we know in 1948, Maslow describes what human needs are. It are the things that we need as human beings to scale. It's the things that make us more productive in society. And when those human needs are met, how productive can we all be collectively in complementing this forward trajectory, particularly, again, in a space of democracy? We realize that needing air and clean water and warm spaces doesn't depend on someone's hue or color of skin or class. We wanted to understand the interplay between human needs, perception, and the built environment, and how that interplay creates a lived experience in our society. And it was important to understand perception, particularly the perception of those who are stewarded and in charge of making decisions and creating outputs within our built environment. So if they are not informed, if they don't have an ability to empathize, how can we create lived experiences that reflect what we all purport to want to see in our society? So we began looking back when people became involved in really injecting and caring about human needs. We know, as was mentioned by Michael Sorkin, one of the panelists here today, industrialization created overcrowding in our cities. And we see that there's this rise of a housing reform movement that wanted to deal with the immediate concerns of the built environment, from lack of housing to the poor ventilation, but never took the stand to understand what are the conditions that bring us to a point where we can see people living in squalor and blight and be so disconnected from that emotion. And we know Jacob Riis captures this in How the Other Half Lives in 1890. And his pictures spark outrage across the country around tuberculosis and cholera outbreaks and the public health crises that these environments have on people. He understood, and the housing reformers understood, the role that environment plays in shifting the ability for people to scale. But simultaneously, as that's happening, as we're raising this awareness and this perception, there's another perception that's going forth. And we coin it in our practice, it's sort of the theory, it's the insidious seed that gets planted. Because we obviously see that human needs is important and we're advocating for it, and we see that philanthropic housing through model tenements emerge. But there's something that people like Madison Grant bring forth. It's the rise of scientific racism and eugenics. It's the rise of shifting perception to even humanize people who look different from you. By a show of hands, how many in this room know of Madison Grant? Madison Grant was a thought leader, was a person that made influential decisions in our built environment. But he also believed in the master race and in white supremacy. He advocated that there is a supreme race, and everything that falls below that is not even human. So it plants a seed of perception on how we even begin to empathize and connect with other people. Madison Grant was a mentor to Teddy Roosevelt. Madison Grant founded many of our national parks, founded what would become the Wildlife Conservation Society, oversaw the construction of the Bronx Zoo, and under his tutelage and leadership of the Bronx Zoo, he also okayed and approved an exhibition where a Congolese pygmy by the name of Otabenga was housed in the monkey house, to share his point that this is not a human being, to reinforce this. He wrote his book, and it got much attention and success. And it was so powerful that Madison Grant receives a letter from Hitler thanking him. And it's what's the basis for Hitler's genocide in World War II. And the people, again, are serving mentors to those who become in positions of power when the government says laissez-faire no more with the conditions of housing. We've heard enough today, the creation of the redlining maps, and we heard enough about how it creates disparities in wealth. But think about this for a moment. Let it marinate. People who are put in positions of authority to steward the ideologies and principles of our democracy are making decisions based on race and class and reinforcing a perception that there are those who are considered valuable in our society and those who are not. This found its way into when, as I said, the government gets involved. So even whether it was through home ownership or if it was through housing or rentals, formerly integrated blocks like the Lung Blocks in New York City, where Jacob Riis takes a lot of his pictures and they say, hey, we have to do something about it, so we're going to. The government constructs amazing housing, Knickerbocker Village, the first houses on the Lower East Side. But think about it for a second. Do you think those houses were integrated? They were segregated. Redlining maps serve as a precursor because, again, it reinforces this perception. And I'm just going to read quickly a quote from the Federal Underwriting Manual, Public Subsidies Being Used to Promote This Practice. And the Federal Underwriting Manual eliminates the use for redlining maps and makes it so widespread. And we speak about the book, The Color of Law, capturing all of this. I encourage you all to read a book called Crabgrass Frontier by Kenneth Jackson. Kenneth Jackson is credited with unearthing these maps in the late 70s and 80s because for so long they were buried and even denied that they existed in our country. His work was very pivotal in creating and activating the conversations we're having today. So again, the book is called Crabgrass Frontier. And here's an excerpt of the Federal Housing Manual, Underwriting Manual. The evaluator should investigate areas surrounding the location to determine whether or not incompatible racial and social groups are present, to the end that an intelligent prediction may be made regarding the possibility or probability of the location being invaded by such groups. If a neighborhood is to retain stability, it is necessary that property shall continue to be occupied by the same social and racial classes. A change in social or racial occupancy generally leads to instability and a reduction in values. So when people tell you that this wasn't about race, that sounds like a lot to me, according to racial lines. When people tell you that race didn't account for much in these evaluations of a survey, they accounted for 20% of a survey, along with 40% being an income to determine which areas were going to receive investments and which weren't. And this begins to fuel a machine of powerful lobbying groups from, I'm sorry to say, the banking industry and the insurance industry, from the architecture industry, from the lumber industry, to the rubber industry, to the automobile industry. So any attempts to stand up to this system was thwarted. Any attempts for the masses who really do believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all was going to change this dynamic, were blacklisted, were denied the lending. If they couldn't get the lending, or if they finally got the lending, excuse me, then the zoning laws would change to require bigger lots and bigger houses, ultimately into the point where the thought of creating a racially integrated community fell flat on its face. And before you know it, as we're going down this trajectory, we see cities that are burning, we see fiscal crisis erupting, and we see the conditions of these communities, but don't look back at a history. And again, it wasn't just about home ownership, because personally, I don't want to leave my neighborhood to move somewhere else. Why couldn't I access the things of good schools, of good hospitals, of good libraries, exactly where I was? Why is it this notion that we have to move somewhere else to acquire that? And it was this thinking that when we look at what do we do to solve the problems of these communities, we begin to blame the people in those communities. Not blame the people like Madison Grant, who are the ones who socially construct race. So when we talk about race, it was people like him who injected it in the conversation. When we know this history, when we can ground it and contextualize it, it allows each of us in this room to do better. Because the dominant perception, when I'm sure many of you try to put housing in homogeneous communities, that NIMBY movement, there's still a perception lingering there. There's still a devaluing and casting of a hierarchy of value towards human beings. That if we don't understand these histories, we can't begin to undesign what's happening. And we are at a time in this country where we're in a downward spiral of our humanity. And if we don't strengthen our humanity, humanity is at the core of democracy. Because if you can't empathize and connect with people, how can you even think that we are all created equally? So what do? We do the hard work. We show up every single day in communities to begin to heal our social fabric, to begin to build empathy in spaces that don't have the opportunity to do that. We create collaborations across race, class, and industry to say, how do you plug in to a participatory design process, not just from the community, but from everyone who are manipulators of this built environment? Because we look at everyone having a role to play in designing, again, this just and inclusive human experience. So we have launched We Labs across the United States. Many are in the formation. One is in Trenton, New Jersey, and one is in the Bronx, New York. And we combine a transdisciplinary approach that captures and narrates this history so that projects that are manifested within the built environment are vetted. How does it bring equity? How does it shift perception by removing vernacular like low income? Removing vernacular like poor people. Looking at human beings as human beings. And as people connect to this space, we invite stakeholders such as yourselves to plug in, who may not have the capacity to show up every single day. Communities steward their own conversations over time. They build a living archive so that as we are seeing massive reinvestment into historically disenfranchised communities, the story isn't whitewashed. Monuments aren't built to great hopes that came in and revitalized our communities. It's preserving the ugliness of Americana so that we don't forget what can happen if we don't become stewards and responsible again for our democracy. This is one example of a project that we worked with the Mary Mitchell Center in the Bronx. And it was very exciting because we steward this participatory design process with youth 14 to 21. And it was amazing for us to see how they connected to their community. They didn't know the architectural buildings that were in their neighborhood that had been knocked down because of policies like planned shrinkage that removed resources from what they considered to be pariah dying zones and put them into healthy areas in places like the Bronx, meaning Riverdale. They were awed to know that there was a train line that ran from the tip of Manhattan all the way to the North Bronx that in 1973 was torn down, something we could never have the money to rebuild today. That when they were able to connect to their space and connect to this history, we had a very different conversation of then how do we create actionable opportunities within the community. That's not about an individual owning a house and building personal wealth, but it's about something called community wealth. It's about employing cooperative models and social enterprises that really are at the anchors, are becoming anchors in our communities to do something different. And they learned about models from all over the world that are doing this. They learned about models that really bring value to every single person in that community. And it offered them an opportunity to be proud instead of the age-old narrative of these communities needing hope. It put it in perspective. And you know what was the anchoring piece of programming that they wanted to see in their community? It was a space for intergenerational healing, which was extremely powerful. Because many of us forget, and this is the community I grew up in, we lost approximately 85 to 90% of our housing stock. And those of us who didn't have the opportunity to leave stood on the front lines of the most impactful conditions that this nation has ever seen. So on the heels of blight and burnout came the heroin epidemic. And unlike the heroin epidemic today that's looked at as a public health crisis, that was criminalized. On the heels of the heroin epidemic, we had HIV and AIDS in our community. On the heels of HIV and AIDS, we had the crack epidemic. And on the heels of the crack epidemic, we had unprecedented violence in our community. It was an unraveling of a social fabric. So for students to connect this history to creating a space of empathy, I don't think you can disagree in this room that we need to heal. We need to come together. And this, ironically, this building is located diagonal from where Khalif Browder used to live. How many of you are familiar with the Khalif Browder story? Khalif Browder was falsely accused of stealing a backpack. And because he refused, he couldn't make the bail, and he refused to plea for something he did not do, he spent, at 16 years old, spent almost 3 years in solitary confinement. It impacted not only Khalif Browder, but his entire family. And shortly upon his release and being exonerated, Khalif Browder committed suicide. So when we talk about equity and we talk about deconstructing our past and redesigning our future, let this be the stories that come to your forefront, what you connect to create something very differently. Empathize. Don't abscond into your corner of life. Realize that we have gotten here by design and by much intentionality. This is another project in Trenton that is exploring innovative community land tenure models. We talk about ecosystem building. And I just want to share with you, again, another image to sear your hearts and mind. The picture in black and white was in the Bronx on 178th Street. Was what the neighborhood looked like when my mother was out. Housing opportunities for a woman of color opened up as white flight was happening in places like the Bronx. Here she was thinking, I'm getting up every day, naively so, that she was going to be part of this Americana and American dream. Unbeknownst to her, that decisions in 1933 destined this community to decline. And the blowback from that left us living in a home that looked like this. All the fires burned all the houses around us. And we lived in a home with 3 rooms and a kerosene heater and no running hot water. And this wasn't the 1930s. So when we look at, again, what is our intentionality, please remember that each and every one of us in here today has been given a gift of democracy. I don't think anything you see here looks democratic. And if we do not rise together as a capital W and capital E, we will never bring full healing that's going to be necessary to be the beacon of light in our darkest moments. A nation that holds life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness at its core should not have us gazing upon a landscape marred with hypocrisies and contradictions. So I hope I inspire you all and you heed to a call of action to do the right thing in resourcing this type of work, because many people want to do this. Create spaces that allow you to do what you do better. Thank you so much for your time, and I really hope to connect with many of you. Thank you.
Wow, I don't know about you guys, but I am completely blown away. April, if I didn't have my remarks written out for me by the hand team, I might be speechless. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Angie Rogers. I'm the director for the New Communities Initiative in DC's Office of the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development. We have just witnessed something extraordinary, something transformative for our region and for our industry. Redlining forever altered our landscape. The effects are economic in how business was done, and they're also personal, as you can see from April's remarks, and how that practice shaped lives and how it shaped whole communities. Overcoming redlining is now a business imperative. Policies don't have to drive our actions going forward. Hand members can write a new script. Small, deliberate acts can shift the pattern and power of movement away from redlining and toward greater, more inclusive opportunity. April touched on a lot of hard truths. But she also offered several solutions that we can implement, both now and in the future, to realize the full potential of affordable housing and community development in our region. Undesigning the red line opens up so many more possibilities. A forgotten neighborhood can soon thrive again. New economic activity can bloom in places that have been overlooked. The next property developed by a hand member could become an anchor that attracts additional investment to areas such as employment centers and retail that hires locally and reinvests in the community. Anything is possible if we harness our collective power. Should you need inspiration in the coming months, the Undesign the Red Line exhibit will remain here in the Washington Metropolitan Region, available to you to visit at the DC Housing Finance Agency. Please go visit, draw inspiration, and develop new ideas and solutions. It's been my honor to take part in today's annual meeting and Housing Expo. Moments such as these are indeed transformative. Thank you for the opportunity to share it with you, and I look forward to all the ways that we can work together and walk boldly into the future. Please welcome, join me in welcoming back to the stage HANDS leaders Heather Raspberry and Ray Skinner.
Thank you, Angie. I know it's been a long day, but we're almost done. In fact, I think we've saved the best for last, because now it's time for our raffles. We got We have a lot of great prizes for you today, but, you know, as they say, you got to play to win. So you have to have put your business card in the jar here, and I'm going to be drawing, or Heather's going to be drawing the winners. I'll just announce the names. But again, we have some very fantastic prizes that have been donated by hand members. And Heather, can you know, are you sure I can't put my card in here?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Okay. First one. I'm going to go through these really quickly now. And again, you have to be in the room to win. So if you're not here, I'm just going to draw the next one. Okay. The first is a $100 gift card from Barcode Restaurant. Ooh. Okay. Bobby Whitney with Habitat America. Where's Bobby? Is Bobby here? I hear people clapping. All right. Yeah.
Hey, Bobby.
When your name is announced, make sure you raise your hand so we can see you. Okay. The next one is a $200 Maine Lobster Direct gift certificate from Boston Capital. And this goes to Nayasha Mandima, who's with the Colvin Institute at Colon Institute of Real Estate Development. Okay. Is she here? I can't see. He. Oh, I'm sorry. He. Okay, I see. He's coming. Okay. All right. Next is an Amazon Echo Dot from Love Funding. Montgomery Housing Partnership, Gloria Castro. Gloria Castro? Oh. Is she here? Okay. Okay, then we have another Amazon Echo Dot. This one donated by Bizzuto Construction Company. And the winner is Patrick Williams, Columbus Property Management. Okay, he's coming. Okay, the next is a wireless IP camera from Hertz Bach & Company. Tiffany Everett, JDC.
Tiffany here?
Is Tiffany here? Raise your hand, wave, okay. Tiffany's here. Next up is $100 gift card from R4 Capital. LaToya Thomas, I know her. Okay, next is $100 gift card from Novogradic and Company. And this goes to Carrie Thomas with Minor Feinstein Architects. Carrie Thomas, are you here?
Carrie back there.
Okay, he's here. She? Okay, next we have a $35 soup and salad gift certificate from Supergirl. And the winner is Mary Ellen DeLuca from Habitat America. She's here. Okay, next we have a pair of Washington National tickets donated by Kuhn Resnick. And the winner is Rianne McWain from CPDC. Rianne, she's here? Okay. Where is she?
She's over there.
Oh, over there. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, next, a pair of Washington Nationals tickets from Cone Resnick. Did I say that?
Yep. No,
okay. A pair of Washington Nationals tickets from Cone Resnick. Okay, the winner is Leonard Clark with Union. Leonard Sayer, okay.
Oh, we've already done that one.
I thought we already did that one. I'm getting mixed up here. All right, so Leonard wins the 2 gift cards and a private business seminar from Apple. Sorry. Trying to do too fast. Next, we have a $50 gift card from KeyBank Real Estate Capital. Actually, we have 2 of those. So we'll... Okay, what?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the winner is Theodore Cage, Winecheck Architects. Associates, Architects and Planners. Theodore Cage?
Eddie?
Theodore Cage? Not here? All right, so. All right, so this is for the gift card, Visa gift card, $50 Visa gift card. It says, look on back.
Gregory Cook.
Mr. Gregory Cook.
Wesley Housing.
President of Hawaii, I think it's Hawaii Tenants Association. All right, Gregory Cook. So that's 1 of the 2 gift cards from KeyBank. Do you have 2? Okay, so this is for a $50 gift card. William Whitman from Somerset Development. William Whitman, Somerset Development. Going once, going twice. We'll draw again. Again, this is for a $50 Visa gift card. Amelia McCarthy. From Montgomery County Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Okay, I see it. She's back there. Okay, this, the next one, $100 Cheesecake Factory gift card, donated by Harkins Builders.
Carmen.
Let's see, Carmen Castro Conroy from HIP, Housing Initiative Partnership. Carmen, I see her, she's coming up. Okay, that was for the $100 Cheesecake Factory gift card. So next, $100 Southwest Airlines gift card from Area Probe, donated by Area Probe. And the winner, Santiago de Angulo.
Santiago?
From Eagle Point Management.
Santiago here?
I know.
You've got to draw it again.
Santiago. Okay, we'll draw again.
Okay, yeah.
We'll draw again. This is for the $100 Southwest Airlines gift card. Angie Rogers, that name sounds familiar. Hey. Director of New Communities Initiative. Have you heard from? Okay, now this is the last gift and the best door prize. This is for a weekend getaway for 2 with breakfast from the Omni Shoreham Hotel, the hotel that we're in right now. And the winner is from the Center for the Study of Social Policy, Joni Hirsch. Oh, she's right here in front of me.
All right, wrap it up.
Okay. Thanks again to all of our wonderful individual and organizations who've donated prizes, and congratulations to all the day's winners. And Heather, you want to close us out?
Thank you.
Hands board, please come to the stage so we can get a photo. Thank you to all of you for coming out. Shouts out to a Round Robin production.